Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I am Richard Sleeper.
And I'm Jacob Austin. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first, Mark Dunley takes us into a news conference on the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. Then, Sina Bazila-Hickey talks to Gina Ahn about Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month and the 518. Later on, Willie Terry interviews Taryn Roberts, author of I Deserve Better and Color, Repeat, Believe. After that, Moses Nagel speaks with Ava Agri of Jewish Voices for Peace about a recent Seder for Gaza. Finally, this week's American Taste by Skidmore student is about cooking burns. But first, here are the headlines.
Nuclear power provides about 22% of the state's electricity, while fossil fuels, primarily gas, account for nearly 50%. Renewable energy accounts for 27%, with 22% of that coming from longstanding hydro. Wind and solar remains in the 5-7% range as the state continues to move slowly to expand renewable energy, especially compared to other states such as California and Texas.
Police with batons and dogs forcibly broke up a pro-Palestinian encampment at SUNY New Paltz on Thursday, arresting dozens and charging them with trespassing.
A homeless encampment in a wooded area in Troy burned on Thursday. The residents claim it was arson, noting that the city of Troy has forced them to move three times since Carmela Mantello became mayor.
Channel 6 reports that Albany County District Attorney David Soares says gang violence is an issue in Albany, but that leaders aren't addressing it correctly because they aren't acknowledging it. The mayor's office responded, quote, "What we are seeing is the unfortunate result of people relying on weapons to settle disputes with people they know." The city added 20 social worker positions to the police department this year in the effort of de-escalating those interpersonal disputes.
With an infusion of $2 million of the county's American Rescue Plan Act funds, the Knickerbocker Arena in Troy plans to reopen for ice skating in the fall.
And those are all our headlines. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation. Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390. The Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act will be a key talking point when the state legislature returns to Albany through early June. The act also was a key talking point at a news conference from May 2nd, where we heard from Judith Enk of Beyond Plastics, Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger, and Jumaine Williams, the NYC Public Advocate.
Now that the state budget has finally passed, lawmakers will return to the state capitol for another month to finish up action on other legislative issues before adjourning for the year. One key issue is whether they will pass the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. New York is facing a solid waste crisis, with roughly 5 million tons of packaging waste generated in the state every year and growing. Localities and taxpayers are stuck footing the bill for managing the growing food of packaging waste. New York City alone budgets almost $500 million just to get rid of waste, of which 30% is made up of packaging and single-use plastic products. From a May 2nd news conference, we hear from Judith Enk of Beyond Plastics, Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger, and Jumaine Williams, the New York City Public Advocate.
Such a pleasure to be with you to talk about what I believe is the most important and most comprehensive plastics reduction bill in the entire country. Just this week, the United Nations had an important meeting in Ottawa, Canada, looking at an international plastics treaty. That treaty negotiation, unfortunately, is not going particularly well. We know that Congress is not high functioning these days. And so all eyes are on state legislatures to try to pass strong bills to reduce plastic pollution. And again, the most important plastic reduction bill in the country is pending in the New York State Legislature. The bill has a tremendous focus on waste reduction, not just recycling. The good news is that the bill passed both environmental committees overwhelmingly in mid-February. Now they're coming back on Monday. We will try our hardest to pass this bill in the month of May. I'm encouraged by the fact that we have 80 co-sponsors in the New York State Assembly, and we have 34 in the State Senate, meaning a majority of the legislators in both houses have signed on as co-sponsors of the bill. So here's what this bill does. It's called the New York Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. The bill requires a 50% reduction in plastic packaging over 12 years. It is incremental. And what I learned is not to do long-term aspirational goals, like cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 60% in 40 years. It requires a 10% reduction in plastic packaging after 3 years, 20% reduction after 5 years, 30% reduction after 8 years, 40% reduction after 10 years, and then we get to 50% reduction after 12 years. Big companies know how to innovate when the law requires them to do that. I want to explain the focus on reduction as opposed to recycling. People should keep recycling paper, metal, glass, cardboard, compost, yard waste, and food waste. But we have to be honest that plastics recycling has been an abysmal failure. It is now my great honor to introduce Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger. Before becoming County Executive, Jen Metzger served in the New York State Senate.
We are seeing the plastification of the planet, literally. It's in our water, our food, our bodies. The rapid growth of plastic packaging production and waste is absolutely staggering. And it's fueling the climate crisis. It's bad for our health and the environment. And it's really overwhelming local communities' ability to manage waste. But it's not just an urban problem. It's really a rural problem, too. In Ulster County, about 17% of our municipal solid waste is packaging alone. And while that's less than in New York City, the burden on rural communities is tremendous because we have less in the way of resources to manage it. And the financial burden is spread across a far smaller number of people. Municipal recycling programs are under serious financial stress. They're on the receiving end of materials that cannot effectively be recycled, and the cost of collecting and processing recycling have increased. I chair the Climate Action Committee of the New York State Association of Counties. And while it's not always easy to get agreement among the state's 62 counties, this is an issue around which all counties have coalesced in support, bridging typical Democratic-Republican divides, urban-rural divides. For 2 years in a row now, NYSAC has unanimously passed a resolution urging the state legislature and governor to address the scourge of plastics and create an extended producer responsibility program that will meaningfully reduce waste and shift the responsibility for the cost to the corporations that generate it. Originally, this legislation included paper, and NYSAC still advocates including paper. The Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act is, as Judith mentioned, it's going to cut waste in half in 12 years, eliminate nearly 20 highly toxic and dangerous chemicals used to make plastic packaging, and it will save upstate taxpayers as much as $150 million a year. It will provide local governments with desperately needed revenue to improve local recycling and reuse programs. And critically, it shifts the cost from our communities to the corporations that are responsible for generating it, which is the just and fair approach to addressing the plastics and waste crisis. We urge our state leaders to work together to get this needed legislation over the finish line. The counties of New York State are fully behind a strong EPR program that will meaningfully reduce waste and costs and responsibly protect public health and the environment.
And we're so excited to be joined by the New York City public advocate, Jumaane Williams.
This year, Earth Day theme call on all of us to put planet over plastics. And so I'm proud that the work my office is doing. My office co-sponsored legislation to reduce the city's dependence on single-use plastic. And while we're coming together with the state's partners today to call for the slate to for the state to now pass the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. That act, it will require companies with a net income over $1 million who sell or distribute certain materials to reduce packaging, improve recycling and recycling infrastructure, financially support municipal recycling programs, and reduce toxins in packaging. I want to make sure we're clear that it's a net income over $1 million. And I think that's a really important distinction because if it was gross, it may be a little bit more difficult. But these are people who are after they've paid all the bills they need to pay are still netting an income of $1 million. And we all have to do our individual part to help protect the environment. Cities and the municipalities and even the government can do its part and set an example. And we can all push the giant corporations during this climate crisis to make real changes. This is helping push the burden to the manufacturers and to the people who are pushing these plastics. We know it's difficult to change once you get used to something, but we have to begin factoring more of the cost, not just in the numbers of dollars, but the cost of our lives, the cost of the planet. And those costs are high, not the changing. And we've done things like set recycling marks, and the recycling that we do is just extremely low. And we need to have the impact that we want. And we still need that impact. So I think a bill like this, changing the burden of who's responsible for changing the type of packaging that we have and getting companies to agree to work with nonprofits and organizations who help reduce waste, cycle, and help figure out how best you can use and reduce packaging is a very smart way to go. And they always say, if you build it, they will come. And so we have to try to build it. There is better ways to package. There is better ways to reuse the packaging. And we know that the companies who are doing business are not always experts in how to do this. And so partnering up with people who are really make a lot of sense. And so there's a lot of diverse type of electeds who are supporting this bill in the state. We have to do everything we can right now. This is also a social justice issue. Climate change itself impacts the communities who are always hit the hardest by everything. Black and brown communities, working class communities, immigrant communities, places where things are, where these type of plastics are created, where they're incinerated, are all in communities that always hit the hardest. And so there's a lot of intersecting things here that we have to think about. So hopefully we can get it done sooner than later. Climate change is not something in the future.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was an excerpt from a May 2nd news conference discussing the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. Thanks to Mark Dunley for producing this piece.
Food, literature, the arts, fitness, and more. There are so many ways to celebrate the Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. Throughout May, there will be many events around the capital region. To learn more, Sina Basilahickey interviewed Gina Ahn.
Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, or AAPI Month, celebrates the diverse and complex histories, identities, and accomplishments of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. In the Capital Region, we celebrate with a wide range of activities, educational programs, and public events. And to tell us more, I'm now joined by Gina Ahn of AAPI Heritage Month, 518, and owner of Sun He's Farm and Kitchen. Welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's start with the formation of this group. You've came together in a bit of a grassroots structure. What does that look like? How has it evolved over the couple of years that this has been existing? What is the function and how does it look now?
Sure. I think one of the first times that there was a bit more structure to the coming together of individuals who are identify as AAPI or Asian American, it was back in 2001 during the Stop Asian Hate movement. And we had formed a very grassroots and non-official, non-formal group called the 518 Asian Alliance. And during that time, a bunch of folks, you know, friends from different professions, all across different age groups, we came together because we felt a call to action and wanted to be able to lift our voices and share our stories. So I remember even during that time, it was very simply on the Sunny's Instagram. Put out a call there, be like, hey, Asian American fellow brothers and sisters, like, come on out. And I remember getting a slew of messages from folks who were so eager to, A, do something, to connect with other AAPI folks in the region, and three, to share their stories. And so from there, we had the 518 Asian Alliance, but, you know, consecutive years, the years went by, there was less media attention, but the end of 2023, even like as far back as a year ago, one of my friends who's a Korean adoptee in the area, she just came up and was like, hey, I got this idea. They did this in other cities across the country, most notably in Memphis, Tennessee. And I want to do this thing of bringing together AAPI individuals again and put on a whole month to just highlight our different cultures, backgrounds, but really even just to with this vision of getting people together again and in the same space.
So who came out of the woodwork? What does the demographic look like in the capital region? Are there certain communities that many people might not be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Even as a grassroots group, we can't say that we represent all the different AAPI groups out there in the capital region. You know, there's also generational gaps. So there's first generation, second generation. I'm something that I call 1.5 generation. I was born in Korea, but I came here when I was 3 years old. And so you have these varied cross-generational, cross-cultural, cross-ethnic groups, you know, and I think even like South Asian, sometimes don't even, like people from India or from Nepal and the South Asian regions, they don't necessarily identify with East Asian cultures. And so we found that a group of us who are primarily either Korean American, a Korean adoptee, or we have even someone who's in PR and she's a Filipina American. So we got together, had some even like vague contacts and connects, and decided to put this thing together.
What do you want people to know and appreciate about AAPI Heritage Month?
Being Asian in upstate New York is a very different experience from being Asian in New York City or in LA, some big cities where it's much less of a like rarity, right? And so I think being, you know, having grown up here and having at times felt very isolated or like I don't belong, I think now as an adult, connecting with people and seeing more Asian Americans in our region and transforming the area with different businesses, with different ideas, different types of professions, we just want people to know that we're here, but also let each other know that you're not alone.
AAPI Heritage 518 has such a range of beautiful events that range from food to fitness, books, workshops, arts. And so I want to kind of go over the range of really exciting opportunities that we have. And I guess something that stuck out to me that maybe is a starting point is wrapping with fabric.
Pochagi, yep.
So maybe let's start with the arts. Previously in Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we had an interview about Threads, the exhibition coming to the Albany Center Gallery. So what do we have in form of the arts?
Yeah. And, you know, I have to say, I am not an expert in the arts at all. You know, food, I mean, culinary arts, but even that, I'm not a chef. And so so I do have to say...
That is an art.
Yeah, it is. It is, for sure. But a lot of people, when they think about, like, Asian, AAPI, Asian American, what comes to mind at first is our food. But I remember even in 2001, one of the things we were promoting is that, you know, we're more than just our food. We're more than just our culture or the things that you like about us. We're more than the dumplings and fried rice, you know, all the things that people quintessentially like think about when they think of Asian culture. And so we were very intentional about having and offering a variety of different programs and events throughout the month. And the thing is, we were surprised at how many people we found who are Asian American and who have specialties outside of the food arena. Because for me, I'm surrounded by food people.
But we can also start from food.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
A lot of our nurturing comes through our stomach. So absolutely. How is the stomach related to this month? Like, what are the many ways that we can satisfy our taste buds and our gut?
Well, for a lot of Asian Americans, like, food is our identity. Like, food is our love language and the way that our cultures are passed on through generations. And it is a very integral part for more than just the flavor and the arts behind it. So what I love is that throughout the month, we have all these different events that highlight a very niche part of different cuisines, different cultures, and even different, you know, so it's not just food, but it could be beverages. And so even at the Sunny Space, we're hosting a soju tasting with Chizong, who is trying to start a Korean restaurant in Troy as well. It's called House of Jeon. And so she has an expertise of having been in Korea and learned the art of making soju, of making very old school, like just artisanal beverages. And so that's something that we're highlighting and learning together in the process. So soju is the classic, it's a rice liquor in Korea. It's something that you drink with Korean barbecue, with a meal. So it is a rice-based beverage that has a real popularity in Korea. Makgeolli is another one. It's an unfiltered rice wine that she'll also be doing a workshop in. That's going to be taking place at Bespoke Bowl, also in Troy. Again, these are all different types of methods, and you know, people think rice wine is all the same, but it's not. Makgeolli and soju are very different, and people will get to experience that. And not only that, there's, you know, bubble tea. There's a plant-based Chinese food workshop, which a lot of people think if it's Chinese food, it's not going to be plant-based. But that's the thing. We have a lot of different offerings, and for people who have different dietary restrictions too. And then as our closing event, we're having the Troy Asian Night Market. And that really revolves around different types of street food and a whole nother culture of being outdoors and eating small bites and having music and, you know, string lights. It all seems small, but when it all comes together, there's a certain vibe there that we love sharing with people.
And where and when is that taking place?
So that's going to be happening in downtown Troy. Location is to be determined, but it's most likely going to be the alley behind Sunny's, the William Street alley. And we'll have a bunch of vendors, including Chibog, a Filipino vendor. We have Lime Leaf, Thai, Sunny's, K-Plate. And so we'll be there on Saturday, June 1st. This will be our closing event for the month's events.
As we mentioned, there is a range of things coming for the month, which we don't have time to get into all of them right now. What's the best way to find information?
Oh, so it's real easy. We set up a website at aapiheritage518.com where you can see a full list of all sponsored events, but then also any event that other partners wanted us to help spread and promote. And so you can learn more about us there. You can partner with us there. You can also buy merch or connect in different ways. So I encourage you to check it out.
Including social media.
Oh, absolutely. aapiheritage518.
So we did go over the food, but there's also books and wrapping and calligraphy and academic work. Oh, yeah. I believe there was one academic work. So there's definitely a wide range of what's coming. So Gina An, thank you so much for speaking with me about AAPI Heritage Month. Would you like to leave our listeners with anything?
Thank you for being a part of this. And we're so proud to be Asian American and be here in the capital region. This is home for us. And to be able to do this for the first time as a collective, it means a lot. Whether or not people come to our events, just this whole process and the experience is really empowering. So thank you, and thank you for having us.
Well, thank you so much.
That was That was Sina Basila Hickey talking with Gina Ahn about Asian American and Pacific Island Heritage Month and Choi.
For those just tuning in, I'm Richard Sleeper.
And I'm Jacob Austin. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Choi, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Choi, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
On Friday, April 19th, Willie Terry interviewed author Taryn Roberts about her children's books, I Deserve Better and Color, Repeat, Believe. This is the second part of their discussion.
You know, I went to another event and I ran across another author that wrote a kid book. I don't remember her name, and it was similar, but she was actually a teacher. And she was talking about how the kids in the classroom have a lot of stories.
Yes.
You know, that impact them, but they don't let it out. You know.
Yes.
So she did a thing where she had a microphone, went around and let the kids tell their stories.
I love that.
Right.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Willie, I'm very careful not to come across or pretend to be some type of expert.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm doing is sharing my story. I'm no expert. I'm no, mm-hmm. Therapist or anything like that. I'm
right.
Just sharing the story. But part of the way I wrote the story, and it's written very simply, and I don't give a whole lot of extra details because I purposely wanted to leave it open, mm-hmm. so that readers could fill in the gaps with their own story,
mm-hmm.
you know, their own personal situation. And I wrote the book for the experts, like the guidance counselors, the child therapists, teachers, other parents. I wrote the book for them, for the experts, to get the conversation started. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, the situation is what it is. You know, I'm not here to, you know, try to figure out why the parent, whether father or mother,
mm-hmm.
whoever it is, it doesn't matter. It's not about figuring out why they're not there,
mm-hmm.
because at the end of the day, what remains the same is that there's a child with a void. That's the point. That's what I'm focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm focusing on the child,
mm-hmm.
and their feelings,
mm-hmm.
and you know, making sure that their needs are being met. And sometimes they just need to see themselves in a situation. I've been on, you know, like I said, about a dozen or so school visits. And when I tell you, oh, my goodness, I remember, I can still,
What was the feedback like when you?
Oh, my goodness. Like, I remember the first one that I went to, it was a school in Newark, New Jersey. And after we did a reading, it was a third grade class. After we did a reading and we were doing a question and answer afterwards, I had a little boy raise his hand, and he said, he asked me to turn to a specific page in a book, and it's a page where the main character Jay is just looking out the window, and he's noticeably sad because that's when he's realizing that his dad isn't coming to pick him up like he thought he was.
Mm-hmm.
So the little boy said, "That's me. I've done that." And it's like, it breaks my heart, but at the same time, it's like, I'm providing you a tool where you see yourself, and, you know, where we're talking about how to get on the other side of this, understanding that it's not your fault, doesn't lessen your value as a person. And it's like, it just kind of validates my purpose for this. He saw himself in my book, and he admitted that he had a hard time at one point, but, you know, he was getting better. And that's just the most rewarding thing there. You know, you hate to hear that a kid is going through that, but at the same time, it's like, I'm possibly doing something to make a difference in his life.
Mm-hmm. So just one question too. I hear what you're saying about that, but what is your main message or theme that you hope people take from this, young people or anybody that read it?
So my main thing is people ask me, why did I write this book or why do I go on these visits and things of that nature? My simple answer is I want to help heal little tiny broken hearts. I feel like if we can heal and get the conversation started earlier rather than later when they're adults and, you know, they have all the scars from, you know, all the disappointment growing up and all this stuff. Like, I feel like if we can get them when they're young and just tend to those wounds early, I just feel like it can make so much difference in these kids' lives. So that really is mm-hmm. my purpose for all this.
Right. Well, be that as it may, you are an author now.
Yes.
And got some experience. And I want to ask you, do you have any advice for, let's say, young readers or students or anybody that want to get involved in the writing Absolutely. Process themselves?
Absolutely. My advice is, you know, again, if there's a story out there that you think the world needs, you know, and you don't see it yourself, write it. Or even if there is a story that you have a similar story to, write it. Write your story, because no one can tell your story like you. So your sauce is different than someone else's sauce. So I say just, and it doesn't, you know, writing doesn't have to be some, I think we scare ourselves sometimes thinking that it had, like, we have to be Shakespeare, you know, or so extravagant with our writing. And it's so not the case. You know, my book is so simple. And the feedback that I get from educators is that they appreciate that I kept it simple. Mm-hmm. And I just encourage people to write their stories, whatever it is. And yeah, don't be afraid to put it out there.
Okay. And my last question would be, we all got to ask you this. Are you working on any new projects?
I am. So it's like, okay, I did that. Now I have like a whole notebook of ideas, but I am working, like actively working on the second book, yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I got to make sure when you come out with that I get an interview. And Mr. Robinson, your book is not one book, it's two books, right?
So it's actually, the book is I Deserve Better,
right.
But then there's also a coloring book called Color Repeat Believe.
Is that part of that? Is it go with that book or just separate?
It is separate. I mean, it does kind of complement it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of I Deserve Better, the mom in the book kind of reinforces some positive affirmations with the main character Jay, and so those affirmations affirmations were key when I was raising Jaden when he was younger. So I created a coloring book just of affirmations, of positive affirmations, with the goal to help promote positive self-talk and positive self-esteem in children. I say in children because I did create it with children in mind. However, I find myself using it. It's actually kind of become kind of like my personal self-care kind of routine. And I've come across so many adults that initially bought the coloring book for their child or niece or nephew or whoever, and ended up keeping one for themselves and getting another one for the child, because adults color. And it actually is a nice way to relax and you know, you sit there and you're just subconsciously repeating the affirmation to yourself. And there's a saying that there's power in repetition. I actually wrote that on the back cover of the coloring book.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly do believe that, you know, there is power in repetition. We practice talking to ourselves positively, even if initially we don't believe it. Over time, you know, with practice and consistency, we believe those positive things. So I think it's important. And I love, you know, that people find the value in it and are, you know, getting it for their kids and for themselves.
Right. And we really need to keep our kids reading books because somehow, you know, they're kind of getting away from it.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. I'm going to give you the last word. Anything else you want to say that I didn't ask you? Anything you want to put out there?
You know what? I just want to say thank you for, you know, giving me this time with you to talk and about my work and about my books. I appreciate your platform and, you know, being able to spread the message even, you know, more so, especially in an area that I'm not from. You know, I mean, we're not far, but still, you know, different area. And I do appreciate very much you taking the time and allowing me to speak with you today.
Okay. And thank you. Tarion Roberts, who wrote a book called I Deserve Better, and she also has a coloring book, Color Repeat Believe. All right. And hope everybody, you know, go out and get a copy of it. Thank you now.
Thank you, Willie. Appreciate it.
That was part two of Willie Terry's interview with author Tarion Roberts. You can find the first part of their discussion at www.mediasanctuary.org.
On Saturday, April 27th, Albany Jewish Voices for Peace hosted a Seder for Gaza in Washington Park to mark the Passover holiday and draw connections between the exodus of the Jews and the suffering going on in Gaza. Moses Nagel reports.
This past week was the Jewish Passover holiday. It's the holiday where Jewish people around the world celebrate and retell the Exodus story, the story of our liberation from Mitzrayim, which is Hebrew for the narrow place, commonly called Egypt. The Passover tradition has always been a liberatory tradition in which Jewish people throughout history in different cultural and historical contexts have reflected upon what our history as an oppressed people mean for us in this moment, and how we can stay true to those values of liberation for all of us. So on this past Saturday, Jewish Voice for Peace hosted what we called a Seder for Gaza event in Washington Park. The Seder is a meal over the course of which Jewish people will retell the story of Exodus through a document called a Haggadah, in which the participants are prompted both to retell the history of Exodus as well as to have various reflections upon these themes of liberation and oppression and what they mean in our moment. And so our goal as Jewish Voice for Peace was to, as Jewish people have done throughout history, take that tradition and adapt it for this moment and this moment of crisis in particular for the people of Gaza, to ask questions about what it means for us as Jewish people, having experienced oppression ourselves, to respond to what we see as a genocide unfolding against the people of Gaza.
I personally love the Passover Seder. For me, it's about the most meaningful kind of ritual that I take part in. But for people who aren't super familiar or can't envision a Seder, and especially an outdoor one in a public park, what actually happened if we were there watching?
For those of you who are familiar with the Seder, it typically takes place indoors around a dining table. And it's a many-course meal in which there are various toasts as the participants progress through the Haggadah. This year, cognizant of the fact that people are being deliberately starved in Gaza, Jewish Voice for Peace didn't want to host a feast, and we didn't want to do an event that did not invite people in and speak to our broader community about how our Jewish values demand a response to these moments. And so what we did is we explicitly said that we will not be feasting in a time of famine, and so our Seder was limited to toasts of water, and we add a matzah, which is an unleavened bread, which in the Seder meal is referred to as the bread of affliction, which our so-called ancestors ate in slavery. And so the event itself took place in the late afternoon. We had approximately 140 people over the course of the event participate in this event in which we had leaders sort of leading that ceremony and participants seated on picnic blankets, chairs, things like that in a big circle around a banner that said Jewish Voice for Peace, Seder for Gaza. And as we went through the Seder, certain portions were led by members of Jewish Voice for Peace who would take on certain speaking roles. And there were certain speaking roles in that Haggadah where the participants themselves would sort of speak in unison. And there were some of the songs. Our goal was to take the form of a traditional Haggadah and adapt that form with content that we felt would match this moment. And so we took some of those traditions of the Seder plate and thought about what do these themes of these different symbols of the Passover holiday, what do they mean in this time of genocide? What do they mean in this time of famine? Similarly, we wanted to complicate the Maggid portion of the Haggadah where we tell the Exodus story by also referencing stories about expulsion experienced by the Palestinian people, about the Palestinian Nakba of 1948, and complicate that narrative. We also spoke about various histories of resistance. We spoke about resistance to depression in the Warsaw Ghetto, in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising of 1943. We also talked about resistance here at home, and particularly given that date, April 27th, we honored Charles Nally and the freeing of Charles Nally, who was a fugitive slave and a formerly enslaved person who lived in the city of Troy and was freed by Harriet Tubman on April 27th. And so this Haggadah event, we felt, was an opportunity for us to center our own Jewishness, our own histories of Judaism, and our practice of Jewish faith practice within those legacies of resistance that inspire us today.
It's such a holiday that's just filled with themes of, as you said, liberation, resistance, and fighting on the side of the oppressed. Do you have anything you'd like to say about the idea of you holding this Seder at the same time as people all over the country, specifically on universities, but in a lot of other places, were holding a similar Seder of remembrance amidst national claims of anti-Semitism on the part of people who are calling for an end to this genocide?
One of the things that Jewish Voice for Peace has been so horrified by the reaction to the genocide occurring in Gaza that's happening in this country is the degree to which Jewish descent, Jewish legacies of non-Zionism and anti-Zionism, which have long histories within Jewish communities within the United States, within Europe, within Israel, and around the world, have been derided as anti-Semitic. We feel this is incredibly dangerous to Jewish and something that needs to be called out, because you're absolutely correct. A Jewish Voice for Peace, as a national organization, is standing in solidarity with students around this country who are protesting and walking out in rage that their universities are complicit and profiting from a country that is committing a genocide, that the ICC has said is plausibly committing genocide, and which has only furthered those actions since that ruling was made. So it is our position that the state of Israel is currently committing a genocide against the Palestinian people, and that it is our duty as Jewish people to stop that. And the idea that standing up against a genocide would be somehow contradictory to our Judaism is just the biggest insult we can imagine to the memory of our own ancestors and the descendant of Holocaust survivors. And the idea that standing up now in this moment against genocide would be anti-Semitic is incredibly hurtful to me personally, and it is incredibly dangerous to this country as a whole. And I just want to note, in particular, this is an issue that was voted on Wednesday, May 1st, the House of Representatives, including Paul Tonko, our own representative here in the city of Albany, voted in favor of an anti-Semitism awareness bill that conflates this critique of Zionism as a settler colonial process and ideology as anti-Semitism. And we reject that wholeheartedly. And we reject that wholeheartedly because it is particularly our Judaism, our understandings of Jewish history, and our understandings of our own Jewish faith practices that lead us to the conclusion that we must stand in opposition to not just the current actions of the State of Israel, but the Zionist colonial process, which has harmed the Palestinian people in such a great degree over the last 100 years, not just since October 7th, not just since 2007, but for over 100 years.
I was especially struck this year by the Haggadah that my father had always used and kind of passed along. It talks a lot about this is your obligation to your ancestors to point out these afflictions, to point out this oppression, also your children and your children's children as well. And sort of that's one of the things I'm most proud of about my Judaism is that long tradition of standing with the oppressed and fighting. So, yeah,
absolutely.
It's especially heartbreaking to see that turned against us.
One of the phrases that we use in our Seder is the Kol Dor V'Dor, which means every generation must view itself as having been personally freed from Egypt, personally delivered from oppression. And, you know, I'm speaking to you as a person with immense privilege who has a safe home, a stable living, who is not subjected to the terrible violence that is occurring in Palestine right now. And I think that it is one of the core messages of Judaism is that with that history comes a responsibility to speak up for the most downtrodden, the most oppressed among us. And I think that is a part of Jewish history that is widely celebrated.
That was Moses Nagel talking with the recent Seder for Gaza hosted by Albany Jewish Voices for Peace. You can find more stories from Moses Nagel at www.mediasanctuary.org.
American Tastes is a course with Dr. Beck Krefting at Skidmore College, an interdisciplinary exploration of the evolution of U.S. cuisines, foodways, and food politics. Krefting worked with her students to make the course final project, an audio story to fit the format of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. This next story is about cooking burns by a student, Chloe Neilwaki.
According to the National Fire Protection Agency, Christmas was the second highest date in terms of the number of fires caused by cooking, after Thanksgiving, of course. Thus, it is important to learn how to both prevent and treat such injuries, in case they do occur. But let me tell you, as someone who's burned themselves in the kitchen before, it is something you would much rather avoid. With that, I'll finally introduce myself. Hello, everyone. My name is Chloe, and I'll be your host for this episode. As you've probably gleaned, this episode is all about cooking burns. I'll be covering basic information about cooking-related burns with a focus on how to prevent and care for them. To this end, I'll be interviewing a school nurse who would like to remain anonymous with some questions on the topic. All right. Thanks so much for joining me. The first question we have is, what types of burns are there?
So there are four different types of burns. There's thermal burns, chemical burns, electrical burns, and radiation burns, which can all be classified by different degrees.
And out of those four, a cooking burn would be considered a thermal burn, which is defined by Stanford Medicine as a burn caused by external heat sources which raise the temperature of the skin and tissues and cause tissue cell death or charring. Can you elaborate a bit on those different degrees?
Sure. So there's typically the first degree burn, second degree burn, and third degree. You know, first degree is relatively mild, which, they're pretty much a superficial burn, but just some redness and pain, but no blistering. The second degree burn is more severe. It's deeper into the skin layers, and, you know, you'll see redness and swelling and blistering. And third degree is, the most severe. That affects all layers of the skin, as well as, the muscles and tendons. Like I said, these are pretty severe. And the area can appear charred and white. There's a lot of skin damage.
Right. And first and second degree burns are the most common levels of burns people usually get in the kitchen. They're what you'd get from touching a hot pan or making contact with boiling water, for example. Which types do you need to seek medical help from professionals for?
I would say some second degree burns, depending how bad, and definitely third degree burns.
Yeah, first degree, you're typically able to treat at home. In third degree, you definitely should seek aid for. So it's second degree that is usually a bit tricky to determine at times. So I would like to note some guidelines for our listeners on when to seek medical help. It is recommended that you do so if the burn is larger than 3 inches in diameter on your face, hands, feet, or a joint. The burn was caused by an electric shock or chemical. You wouldn't really have to worry about this one with a cooking burn, which again are thermal. There is pus or other fluid leaking from the burn. The pain gets worse with time. Some skin was burned away. Or lastly, if the burn smells bad. But if you were to treat these burns at home, how would you do so?
Well, for a first-degree burn, a more, mild burn, you can just treat it at home by, putting the burn under cool water. You can apply, Vaseline or petroleum jelly to the site, and just keep it covered and keep the area clean, with the bandage. If it's something like sunburn, which I guess is technically a first-degree burn, you'd want to stay out of the sun. And there's things like, aloe and other sunburn products you can apply, things like that.
Now I would like to ask just a few questions on your personal experiences with treating burns as a school nurse. How often do you have students come in with burns?
Not too often at the high school level. We have students that, they use hot plates in labs. So the once or twice that I had a student come in so far with a minor burn, it's usually from those type of things. They burn themselves on the hot plate. Or if sometimes they'll come in maybe with a burn they got at home. Sometimes if girls are using, curling iron or whatever. Mm-hmm. But nothing severe or, very minor burns at school.
Have any of the kitchen staff ever come in with a burn?
They have not, but that is definitely a possibility, something that could happen. I mean, the kitchen staff are technically, they don't really come to the school nurse because they're technically contracted outside of the district, but that is definitely a risk of their job. They have to be careful.
As we're approaching the holiday season, with winter break, Christmas, and Hanukkah, I would like to ask if you have historically found that incidents of burns in students increase around this time?
I haven't really noticed burns. This is my first year at the high school level. Previously, I was with elementary, so it's a little bit different. So I guess maybe we'll see, but maybe the kids at the high school level are more likely to participate in cooking and things like that with their family at home. So we'll see, but my experience so far, I haven't really noticed burns. Typically what we see after holiday breaks is everyone is sick, but yeah. Not necessarily burns.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks so much for joining me. Now, I would also like to add what you should do to prevent a burn from occurring in the first place. You'll first want to limit the number of people in the kitchen at once. An overcrowded kitchen makes cooking hectic and impairs people from focusing on potentially dangerous tasks. Keeping your children and elders out would also do you good. Cleveland Clinic states that they're the most at-risk groups in terms of being burned when cooking. The second tip is to wear protective gear. This includes oven mitts, long-sleeve shirts, pants, and closed-toed shoes. Though it may be hot in the kitchen, these items can shield you from grease splatters and such. Make sure not to wear baggy or loose clothing, though, as they can catch flame. My last tip is to keep the area you're cooking in clean. Move all flammable items out of harm's way, and make sure there's ample room to set down any hot pots or pans you might use. Remember, prevention is the best medicine, and a burn is one of the last things you should want for your happy holidays. We're all human, though, and accidents happen. So, I'll lay out the information you'll need in the event that a burn does occur. According to the AID, you'll want to start by immediately putting the afflicted area under lukewarm or cool water to bring down the temperature of the burn. Make sure not to use cold water or apply ice, though. Doing so could cause further damage rather than help. You'll want to run the burn under water for roughly 10 minutes. Then, apply an antibiotic cream, such as bacitracin. Petroleum jelly can also be used, though, as an alternative. This will help prevent an infection. The area should then be wrapped in a sterile bandage. Gauze is ideal. Throughout the healing process, you'll want to reapply the cream roughly twice a day. If any blisters form, make sure not to pop them, no matter how tempting it is to do so. Popping them can increase your likelihood of having the injury infected. Lastly, keep the burn out of sunlight to prevent scarring. And that brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I hope the information I've gone over helps your holiday season go by smoothly.
Hear more stories by Skidmore students of American taste at our website, mediasanctuary.org. And before we end tonight's show, we want to invite Sanctuary's programming coordinator, Sina Basila-Hickey, to give a bit of an overview of events this month at the Sanctuary. Hi, Sina.
Hey, Dick. Hi, Jacob. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, it's just the beginning of May now, and we have a couple really fun events coming up. Beginning with Community Radio Days, which happens every month. Jacob, you led the conversation last month. This month, we have Lavender coming up from Poughkeepsie to welcome new producers and just have a great conversation. That is on Monday, May 6th. We also have a plant swap. Dick, I think you're particularly interested in this one. We've got at Collard City Yes. Growers. We will be swapping our plants. If you don't have a plant to swap, come anyway. It'll be a fun time. Saturday, May 11th. And then on Saturday, May 18th, we have Defense Part 2. The Line Becomes a Territory with Margareta Howitt. And then on Friday, May 24th, Community Acupuncture has this month's, or there will be this month's Community Acupuncture with People's Health Sanctuary. And we end the month with the Thursday, May 30th, with Indigiqueer artist Theo Jean Cuthand, a participatory radio workshop. This is going to be really exciting. We're working with MPAC on it, and they sound like a very, very interesting artist. So we hope to see some listeners here this month. So thanks for letting me plug that. Dick, back to you.
All right. Thank you for that. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Richard Sleeper.
And I'm Jacob Boston. We thank all our volunteers who made today's episode possible. This is a team effort. Thanks to Mark Dunley, Willie Terry, Moses Snagel, Skidmore student, Chloe. I'm sorry I got your last name wrong if you're listening. My guy Richard. This is his second time. He's getting better every day.
Thank you.
Our engineer also, Sina Basila-Hickey, we appreciate you. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and it is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a Sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Mag. Or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website and on your favorite podcast platform. And thanks to you, our listeners, for making this all worthwhile.